So the times from leaving Cornell in 57.
Right.
And also along the way in 64-5 while I was on sabbatical, I got promoted to full professor. So I came in 57 and I was full professor in 64 and was at that time the youngest full professor in Maryland.
Mm-hmm. So
I felt I'd accomplished that.
Yeah.
But in 60, you know, as it got, when I came back and I was so immersed in the experiments and programming that after a while I got restless because high energy physics was becoming more and more a logistics problem, a bureaucratic problem, organizing a team instead of just a team of three to write a paper or a team of five to do an experiment. It was getting to be teams of 15 because various laboratories were working together.
Oh, I see.
Nowadays, if you see a paper in high energy physics, it'll be a team of 100. I mean, it's just,
oh.
It was, where do you get the money, and where's the car come from, and how do you bust the equipment? I mean,
oh.
And, you know, and that was all falling to me because I happened to be that kind of guy.
Yeah.
And I figured, the hell with this, I didn't need this.
Yeah.
So I missed the physics, but I figured if I was going to be an administrator, I might as well be an administrator. And in the fall of 69 and the spring of 70.
Right.
College Park was enmeshed in the same kind of Kent State stuff. And we had tear gas and National Guard. And there was a big rumblings from the students and the faculty that the president should get off the campus. So the Board of Regents decided to make the whole system of campuses be another layer. The president of Maryland in my years then, up until then, was named Elkins, Wilson Elkins. Very interesting man. And I was getting involved in being on the faculty senate, and he put me on a committee, which was an intercampus committee, to consider whether Maryland on the Eastern Shore, which was a traditionally black campus in the state of Maryland, whether that should be incorporated into the University of Maryland. It was sort of a...
Oh.
It was your... Maryland is a... In the Eastern Shore of Maryland is a deep south state, mentally. And this campus out on the Eastern Shore of Maryland,
mm-hmm.
Way down at the end, was just the black college.
Yeah.
And so the question in 68 and 69 was, should it be incorporated into university? And there was a committee put together, of which I was a member, with members from College Park, which I was one, from the University of Maryland in Baltimore City,
mm-hmm.
and soon to be started, University of Maryland Baltimore County, UMBC. So I had some visibility at the intercampus level, at the Board of Trustee level on this committee, and I got interested in the whole question. When they decided to move Elkins off the campus and make him president of the system,
mm-hmm.
and start looking for now chancellors of campuses,
yeah.
And have a first ever chancellor at College Park, and the board decided to do that in the spring of 70. I had my name in there as a long shot, but nonetheless interested. They brought in the first ever chancellor, whose name will come to me, Bishop, Charles Bishop, from Arkansas, to be the chancellor. And since he was looking around for vice chancellors, there was no such thing as vice chancellors, and he was going to be in charge of just that main campus.
Mm-hmm.
My name was brought to his attention, and he invited me in the summer of 70, and I decided to go as a vice chancellor, not one of the line vice chancellors, but what you might call a staff vice chancellor for academic planning and policy.
Okay.
And in a way, it was kind of a fifth wheel. You had your standard vice chancellor for students, your vice chancellor for academic affairs, and your vice chancellor for business affairs. And then there was this fourth wheel. And so I got all the other things, all other. And other included, for example, coming into office in September of 70, the fact that the whole campus was going disintegrate.
Mm.
The faculty senate was in uproar all the time. They were They got Elkins out, but they didn't know what to do. They couldn't cope with tear gas. They were canceling classes. The Senate wasn't following its own bylaws, so as a body, it was not credible. It was a mess. And there were physical problems. My cohort, the business vice chancellor, was nominally in charge of the cops. But the cops were out there on the mall in the middle of tear gas, and one famous time, I was the only one around, and one of the plainclothes cops was going to be stomped by a mob, and so I had to go in and get him out. Oh. And there was other things. So among us four vice chancellors and the chancellor, we decided to do something which would try to draw everybody together. So we decided to reorganize, academically reorganize the campus. And that gave me an opportunity to reorganize the campus senate so it became viable again and interested in something other than canceling classes and whether you gave grades or whatever.
Yeah.
Which was just, in my opinion, a bunch of nonsense.
Yeah.
And that was a project. We took on that project. And I had some other projects, so I was a project kind of guy. And that ended up taking 3 or 4 years. From my former physics colleagues, not Snow, not Suture, but a lot of others, and it was a big department by then, mm-hmm. 100-odd people, they just detested anybody who was an administrator.
Oh.
So they had just cut me off. And that was very painful.
Yeah.
And in fact, one of them crossed the street to spit at me one time.
How horrible.
And, it's a good thing I went to boarding school. Because you learn how to...
That's so mean-spirited.
Be inside yourself.
Yeah.
Anyway, Bishop was very good and very organized. And in particular, he was good with Elkins, who was feeling his way as a president. Johnny Toll had left the physics department the year before, 2 years before, to go to be the president of Stony Brook, SUNY in Stony Brook.
Yeah.
When it was a brand new university. He made it a world-class university out of it. And then he came back, as a matter of fact, to be the assistant president of the University of Maryland. And I was always very friendly with Johnny. And whenever he'd come out here, I'd get together with him out here. Elkins retired not too long afterwards. I mean, he got a place organized, and he got it together. And he brought up to central headquarters his right-hand man from the campus, who was vice president of academic, Lee Hornbeck. And we four vice chancellors came in with Bishop as a chancellor. Bishop lasted for 5 years or 6 years, I think. And then he went off to be the president of Arkansas. I'm a little confused. I have to think about that. He left the College Park and went back down south. No, he went to North Carolina or Arkansas, I forget. And they brought in a physicist, actually, the second chancellor, named Gluckstern. Bob Gluckstern. I had accomplished the reorganization with a lot of political activity in 4 or 5 years. Mm-hmm. And it was somewhat typical of what I would do. It was sort of beautiful in theory, but it was the ultimate in herding cats, and it was just like Los Alamos. It was impossible to remain stable.
Oh.
Now, I left after 8 years in 78, and by 80 or 81, the various factions that I had glued together came unglued, and they took away most of the reorganization. The key aspect of the reorganization that was my gift to the world, but didn't last very long, was that and part of my problem is I'm always too far ahead. See, it's like this librarian thing.
I understand.
The key was to put together the disciplines, the departmental disciplines that were essential to the colleges and make them in a unit and have a provost over those divisions. So there was a division of mathematics and engineering and sciences, physical sciences. So you had the College of Engineering, and you had the Department of Physics and Math, and they were all together.
Okay.
And you had the Division of Life Sciences, so you had the College of Agriculture and the other. And in particular, in the humanities, it made eminently good sense. Home ec would be in this and so on. So it was a beautiful thing, great graphs and everything. the sand in the oyster was agriculture.
Oh.
It was very interesting. There was a lot of resistance in engineering. There was a lot of resistance over where the law school was. There was a lot of resistance here and there. Not law school, but business school, excuse me. But the thing that blew it apart was College Park was the land-grant university of the state of Maryland from the 1860s. Agriculture is the heart of land-grant.
Yeah.
At 4-H, you have research, teaching, all the rest of it. People in agriculture at University of Maryland and most land-grant universities, I spent a year going around to other universities as a sort of a sinecure before I left, they considered themselves in the long, you know, the original land-grant universities as the king of the campus.
Ah.
And nobody was supposed to touch agriculture.
Yeah. Sacred.
And I went on broken glass on my hands and knees to the dean of agriculture and pleaded. And they gave lip service to it. They didn't mind being next to the Department of Botany, but the College of Agriculture coming under a provost, having a dean under a provost, they never could get past, like the State Department, they never could get past the language, the protocol. What was a provost? Why was a provost over the dean of agriculture? The dean of agriculture was the oldest dean in the world.
Yeah. So.
And they eventually went back to the regents and blew it apart.
Oh.
I mean, I've done some things at San Diego State the same way, but I'm smarter than San Diego State.
Well, it's the culture of these people.
Oh, absolutely.
It's all about their culture.
Yeah. And what I learned was that it was exactly the same.
Yeah.
In the State Department. In the U.S. federal government, in the state government.
It's very interesting.
It's you have to transliterate between the language, but the concept's all the same.
Yeah.
There are little bureaucracies, there are little domains, there are people who are embedded and who give lip service and nod, and who have civil service or who have tenure or who have what have you. There are remnants of that reorganization. It was called the Academic Organization, and it took us. And I had a study group, I had a committee, AOSC, the Academic Organization Study Committee. And I used it to ram through the campus, the newly created campus senate. So the senate came together. That was an accomplishment. The senate had disintegrated under tear gas and all the rest of it. And the pressure on the faculty took it apart. Because faculty wanted to give students credit when the campus was closed and give them no tests, and how do you put it into the admission? And of course, faculty don't care. How do you put that into their record, into the student affairs records? And so when we came in, it was nothing there. And the student affairs guy, he went nuts and he got replaced after about 2 years. The academic guy named Colcott and I became very close. Because he had to pick up all those pieces, and he was a true faculty guy, which is exactly right. Unfortunately, at that point, you also needed somebody who had bona fides as a faculty member, but who was a real battle axe, and that was me. And the student affairs had to figure all the details, the bureaucracy. How do you record the grades? Where do you record the grades? They hadn't computerized anything. And what do you do with students who just didn't go to class because they were marching in the street?
You know? Yeah.
And, of course, all kinds of universities had these problems. But we had a change of the whole organization at the same time. We went from a campus to a system in practice and had the first ever chancellor.
Wow.
So it was interesting.
It's a special time.
It was a very interesting time. So, in fact, what happened was we came in as a new administration and had to simultaneously pick up the pieces, glue them back together, and start off over again. And I'd say one of the accomplishments that we did, and Bishop was good at this, was we revitalized the Faculty Senate, gave them this project to work on, got through the National Guard period, so to speak, got back to being stable. And in the meantime, there was this interesting administrative problem of how do you administer and how do you structure a major campus? And by that time, Bishop was on the verge of leaving, and it was clear I should get out because, you know, this fourth vice chancellor thing just doesn't work very well in practice. Only the three are really significant. And then the other one would be fundraising. And so I started looking for another job. And in my last year, they were kind enough to send me up to UMBC, where my colleague from the previous years, who was the business guy, John Dorsey, was the new chancellor of UMBC. And so I went up there as the interim academic vice president and did that part. So I learned how to do that. And then I got the job in San Diego State. But I had been looking for a job for about a year. Mm-hmm. And San Diego State was a perfect transition because it was about the same size. College Park is a big place, and San Diego State had, at that time, had maybe 30,000 students. San Diego State is not a land-grant university, so it's very difficult. From my point of view, getting out from under agriculture was like getting out from under purgatory.
Yeah.
And there were a lot of other things, so that's a good place to probably stop here.
Okay.
Okay. Let me go back to College Park for a minute to clarify. There was the Morrill Land-Grant Act that Lincoln got through, and in the education circles, in public education in particular, that act stands supreme as the beginning of the concept of bringing education and the results of education to the common folk of the whole country. Every state has a land grant college, and it never has very much money. I mean, it never appropriated very much money, but it embodied the concept that each state had to have a public university which had an agriculture complex department or whatever, which carried on research, which was the first time the federal government sponsored, so to speak, research, carried the results of those research to the people, and had education, not only in the college, but things like 4-H and stuff like that. And various states picked it up as we went along, and then, of course, after the Civil War, other states came into the Union, and they came under the Morrill Act and so forth. Maryland was one of the original states, and it had College of Agriculture, and it had the three arms of research, teaching, and service. And the fact that research was there was a major, major, major thing. It wasn't until the Second World War that it became big. But agriculture, the agriculture culture on land-grant colleges is a very special culture. And it's typically has older faculty because it's one of the departments that's been around forever. And they typically are very close to the earth. They're very close to the farmers, very close to the people. So they're very political, very, very political, in the best sense of the word. And in particular, they think that the way they are is the way the world should be, as faculty, as a college, as everything else. Gracious, wonderful people, but absolutely intransigent. They just, you cannot change their mind. And in running this project, which we were doing for a variety of reasons, not least of which was to repair the faculty senate, to change the mood of the campus, but from my perspective, it was a great concept to have colleges embedded with the supporting departments, so agriculture would be in the same place as botany and so forth. I mean, what could be better? Not to the land grant people. Not to the dean of agriculture, who felt that we were essentially downgrading him to put him under a provost. Who the hell was going to be a provost? And another major thing is that Maryland, like many states, not all, the board of trustees, the board of regents in the case of Maryland, was also the state board of agriculture. And it was part of the state laws and constitutions that board had to be especially sensitive to the interests of land-grant agriculture. And that had been there since 1865. And so all the faculty and the dean of the College of Agriculture, who was a sacred person, had a direct
line into the Board of Trustees or the Board of Regents in Maryland. So not only was I trying to herd a bunch of cats on the campus and trying to make the agriculture people understand, but the chancellor in this case, Charles Bishop, who was the first chancellor of the campus, and he was in agriculture. He came, his life profession was agricultural economist. He was constantly doing the politics with the Board of Agriculture, who was also his boss, his Board of Regents. Well, but by a variety of ways, we got them on board. The whole plan eventually went to this reconstituted Senate. There were a lot of pieces of this plan, most of which were relatively non-controversial, except for the structure thing. We finally got it approved by a divided vote. I don't remember what the numbers are, but it was like, you know, 55-45 on those issues. I insisted on the question being divided. It went to the board, and Chancellor Bishop had done his work with President Elkins, and Elkins was not in agriculture, but he was a very astute politician. And we got the Board of Regents to approve the plan on this issue, the agriculture part, putting the college under provost, with the departments related, life science departments, that was approved. But they never gave up. And they went out into the countryside and they talked to the farmers and they talked to 4-H. And, you know, and then I left. And after about 5-6 years, a tsunami came flowing back from the countryside. And the board at that time then disentangled it. I think they still left a division here and a division there, but they were divisions which didn't have the political clout of the agriculture people. So when I came to San Diego, it was like getting out of prison as far as the concentration of the usual faculty feelings of supremacy and whatever, plus the real honest-to-God down-in-the-earth politics of an agriculture college. The only thing close to that is a medical college. Law is a distant third. They think they're the best, but agriculture is first, medicine is second. Now, medicine in Maryland was a separate campus. It was the city of Baltimore. And in the new system, it was the University of Maryland in Baltimore. Mm-hmm. And then there was a brand new campus, University of Maryland in Baltimore County, which was a liberal arts campus at the beginning. It's now quite a bit more. And then there was the Eastern Shore campus, University of Maryland Eastern Shore, which I was part of the committee that brought that in. San Diego State had no law school, it had no medical school, and in particular had no agriculture school. But it was large, and it was it had a couple of things which I'll go into as we go into it. And so I felt it was great.
May I just ask you how you were approached and how this all began regarding San Diego State?
Well, I think I mentioned that Charles Bishop was the first chancellor of College Park, and he came from North Carolina, and not as a chancellor, but as a vice president, and his background was agricultural economics. He came in the fall of 78, and I was approached by him in the summer of 78, as were the other three vice chancellors. By 1985, he was looking to go elsewhere. And so, and subsequently he went, I think he went to the University of Houston, I'm not sure, and then from there he ended up his career at in Arkansas. And after he retired, he went back to North Carolina. In any event, he was looking to go elsewhere, and it had been a very hard time for him. I mean, I described some of it from my lower perspective, but to come into a totally chaotic campus where the president was essentially ridden out, and then he came in, no Senate, the faculty were everywhere. From 78 until 85 was a very hard time. And you have to remember, in those days, in 70, 75, the average lifetime of a public university president was like 3 years. So for a year or so, I had started to be looking around 85 or 86. He left, and a new chancellor came in, Gluckstern, who was a physicist, and in fact, I think is still on the physics faculty at College Park. And so it was clear that he didn't see any point in having me around because I was not one of the usual vice chancellors. And we had finished this big project, plus a bunch of other little projects. I had helped with the library, helped with the computer center, and various other things. And I was perfectly happy to move on. And so I had been taking interviews. There were some headhunters were helping me, and I was looking for a presidency all through 85, 86. And he was kind enough, and in the meantime, my colleague, John Dorsey, who was one of the four vice chancellors, the money guy and the financial guy, and he was very favored by the president who left. He was made by the president the chancellor of UMBC, Baltimore County, which was a brand new place. And John had me come up as the acting vice chancellor for academic affairs. So you worried about the faculty, and you worried about graduation and all kinds of things. And that was my last year, 86-7. And through that year, I really looked in earnest for another job. The previous year, I had spent on assignment, sort of detached service, going to other campuses and wrote a little paper about what other campuses did about things. And I was also interviewing, went to Arkansas, as a matter of fact, to be interviewed, went to a lot of different places. But nothing was particularly interesting. But there is an educational mafia, if you like, in one DuPont circle, where all the national organizations of higher education have offices. And so University of Maryland was in an inner circle called the AAU, the American Association of Universities, and those were the creme de la creme because they had a lot of research. And then there was another one which goes by the acronym NASLGUC, which was the National Association of State Colleges and Land-Grant Universities. So those were the land-grant places. And then there's a third one, and this shows you the kind of structure, the political circles called ASCU, which is the American Association of State Colleges and Universities. Those typically do not have research. The NASLGUC people, being land-grant, have research. And the AAU is public and private, and exemplifies research. It's the Stanfords, the UCLAs, and so forth. So I had been going to these places, getting my face around. In the final year, 86-7, Brave Golding, who was at San Diego State, was retiring, about to retire, and had in fact retired that year, 85-86 or so, to go back to Ohio. And so there was an interim president of San Diego State. The chancellor of the system of the state university, it was called CSUC in those days, California State University and Colleges, plural, was Glenn Dunkey. And he literally, actually, was the second chancellor, but the first chancellor, when they set up the system under the California Higher Education Plan, they brought in a chancellor from New York who lasted only like 1 year. His name was Gallagher. And he lasted from 61 to 62. Dunkey then was in office in 1962, and when I was looking in 86-7, he was looking for a new president for San Diego State. And he had heard about me. I did not apply or anything like that. I mean, it was, you know, you don't apply for these things. So he came to Baltimore, and I was at UMBC, and he wanted me to come talk to him. And I knew who he was, of course. And I knew that there was a vacancy in San Diego State, but it was one of several that I was looking at. And so we had a very good chat, and I was very impressed with Dunkey. And to make a long story short, he decided to make an offer to me. I forget. It's in some of those little pocketbooks that I gave you in the computer thing. Mm-hmm. But probably in the late fall or something like that. And then I had to go out and talk to, they had a search committee of faculty, students at San Diego State and the board. And I went out, and then I went out with my wife, and then I think it was in March, more or less, March, April of 78. I should have been saying 85 or 86.
Yeah, it's 75, 76, 78.
So in the spring of 78, I went out and the board appointed me. And then I visited the campus once or twice, once just in passing, and then once seriously to be interviewed by all the constituent groups. Although in 78, it wasn't as bad as it is now. So it was a relatively painless problem. And my wife came out with me, and then the board trustees had a meeting, and I was appointed. And so I came out once or twice in the remainder of the year, academic year of 78, and got to know some people and meet some of my central staff and got to know the campus. I guess a couple things attracted me. One, as I said, it was very comparable to College Park in the sense that it was big. In money in that days, it had, I don't know, an $80, $100 million budget. But most important, it had a significant amount of research going on in the faculty. That was unusual to the point of being exceptional in the California State University system. Only one or two other campuses had any research in what I would consider research in the AAU, in the Nazzle book sense of research. Mm-hmm. And when I looked into it, and I did my homework, which I usually do, it had a foundation, the San Diego State University Foundation. And when I went into that and looked at it, and read the bylaws of the foundation and carried it all the way up to the state laws governing the California State University, which were the organic law which runs that because it's the public university, in contrast to University of California. Mm-hmm. And then from the law comes the education code of the law, and from the education code comes the Board of Trustees, and from the Board of Trustees come trustees' actions, which are codified, and that runs the place. And when you read all that stuff, you find out that the foundations have very special places. They are quasi-private. They are private in the sense of having their own board, they have their own bank account, they have their own employees, but they're quasi in the sense that the president of the campus is the president of the board, appoints most of the board, and can overrule the foundation in certain matters that internally affect the university. So being the kind of person I am, that looked beautiful. I mean, that meant that you had all the benefits of the state paying everybody's salaries.
Yeah.
So you didn't have to be like Hesburgh running around to get money. So most of the overhead was paid, in the overhead sense, and yet you had a place where there was fungible money, which was accounted for with the feds. Mm-hmm. Most of it was federal research money. And there was a teeny bit which was state money from tradition. But it was totally under your supervision and your organization. So you had all the benefits of a private institution. And it wasn't very big at that time, but it was clear from the structure of the laws to me, mm-hmm. even, and I had read this before I saw Dumkey in Baltimore, that it was the best of both worlds from presidential executive point of view. You had to know and follow the laws of the state. You had to be responsible, of course. First, they were set up to be regional universities, in contrast to UC campuses, which each of them are by definition statewide. They're placed in places, but their mission is to be statewide. So UC is not a collection of universities. There's only one University of California. It's just the University of California at the outpost called Los Angeles, or at the outpost called Davis.